vibes. Welcome back to another episode of the Hoop Genius podcast brought to you by NBA 2K26. It's myself, Mo Moonsy. Alongside me is always the legendary coach, Brendan Sir. And we bring you today another legendary coach. Right now, coaching over at USC is Mr. Eric Musselman. Eric, how you doing?
I'm doing great, Mo. I appreciate you and Coach Sir having me on.
It's a pleasure.
Mus and I go back 30 years, Mo, and we coached together. We coached against each other in the CBA, which is a year older than the NBA. And he was by far the best in the business there, and always had great teams. His dad, Bill, God bless him, is one of the absolute incredible coaches at the collegiate and the professional level. He and I have been friends probably 45 years. Just a spectacular coach, X and O's, every part of him. And he taught his son unbelievably well. And Eric and I are best of best friends. And I've learned a lot from him. And I cherish our friendship.
I feel the same way, B.
Man, that's beautiful. If you guys listened to our previous episode with the great Coach Fizdale, you'd have heard him tell some stories and refer to Mus. So we thought we got to get Mus on the show for you. So, you know, how's your season going so far, Coach? Let's start at the top right there.
No, we're good. We're 10-1. We actually have a game, that's coming up on Sunday as well. So it's an important time for us. We're just wrapping up non-conference play. And then we get back into Big Ten play. We're 1-1 in Big Ten conference play right now. And after the holidays, we'll get back. We have a long road trip. It's actually the only Big Ten three-game road trip. We go at Michigan State, at Minnesota. So it'll be the first time that the league has actually sent a team out for three games on a road trip. So looking forward to getting back after the break and getting ready for Big Ten play. But we're excited about what's going on right now at USC, and we know we still got a lot of work to do as well.
For our listeners who don't know, obviously you're currently coaching in the NCAA and you've coached various teams in college basketball, but you've also coached in the NBA. What would you say is the biggest difference in coaching in the NBA compared to the NCAA, where you might only have guys for 1 year or 2 years before they go, compared to the NBA where you're trying to build a franchise?
I mean, there's so many differences. I know that per diem is a big difference. That's for sure. I know the cities that you travel to in the NBA are all premier cities, and you're staying in Ritz-Carlton. So those are two differences. But there's just so many differences from an X and O standpoint. You know, in college basketball, baseline out of bounds, offense and defense is super important. In the NBA, side out of bounds, right, offense is super important. Late game situations are completely different in college. Not being able to advance the ball, I think, is a horrible non-rule that we have. Yep. Basically, at the end of games, it's just luck a lot of times if you have to go full court. But in the NBA, there's so much strategy that goes into late game situations. By being able to advance the basketball. I'm a little confused that the NBA has a G League, FIBA, women's basketball, and we don't. And then I think from a substitution pattern, playing a 48-minute game as opposed to a 40-minute game also changes your substitution pattern. So there's a lot of differences. And then you get into the fact of in the NBA, you're coaching grown men that have families. I guess in college now we're starting to coach grown men that have families.
I saw a thing the other day of like the youngest and oldest players in college basketball. And it's like the oldest was born in 1996. And I was looking at it like, well, I was born in 94. I've still got all my eligibility left. So come on, coach, what's going on?
Well, we have one of the oldest guys in college basketball here, Chad Baker Mazar. And so, when a player has eligibility, a lot of players are taking advantage now of the name, image, and likeness aspect of this whole thing. Whereas even 3 or 4 years ago, I mean, we had players that were leaving the University of Arkansas to pursue their professional career, even though they might not be draft picks, but they wanted to start their career. We had guys like JD Notte, third team All-American, that is currently playing in Europe and having a great, but he had time on his clock, so to speak.
Right.
But he wanted to start his pro career. And I have much respect for players that believe in themselves and want to start their pro career early. I really do. And Mason Jones is another guy that, you know, has played for several different NBA teams, although he was not drafted. And so, you know, there's just different ways to go about your career. But I think if you want to be a pro player, you know, sometimes you got to leave early, and that's the best thing for you long term.
Hey, Mus, I'm going to make you the commissioner of the NCAA now. That's some real shit to think about that, I know. But for you to be the commissioner, and you started to harp on it, I have huge pet peeves about college ball and how, as the inventors of basketball, the United States, how and Canada, we give Mr. Naismith some props, how we could screw it up so much compared to the rest of the world. What things, if you were running college basketball, what things could we do, we'll say, to improve it, the overall game?
Yeah, I mean, I think there's a whole bunch of stuff.
Yeah, I think,
Coach,
so.
But I do, like, little things like, you know, and I think it was the year that you were in the D-League as well, we experimented with the goaltend call, you know, where you're able to knock the ball off the rim. And I thought it added excitement, you know, much like FIBA, especially on free throws. Like, we used to practice it when I was coaching the Reno Bighorns, practice knocking the basketball off the rim when it hit. So I think there's, in my opinion, I just wish everything was worldwide, that we had the same rules as FIBA, as close to the NBA as we possibly can. Shorter shot clock, I think, would make the game better. More decision making would help develop our players more with more possessions. So I think there's a whole multitude of things that we could do to make our game better. But the problem is, you know, a lot of times you sit in a Big Ten or an SEC meeting, and people are giving their opinions on the rule changes, but they've never been a part of NBA or FIBA rules. So they're only going off what they're comfortable with.
Yep.
And so I do think that people that have coached in multitude of leagues, like Fred Hoiberg and people like that, I think that we should utilize their opinions more than maybe guys that have been coaching college only for the last 40 years.
The great Tom Izzo, who is in your league and a great, great friend. I remember years ago, he said to me, every guy that I have in my program or comes to my program wants to play in the NBA. And if a kid came to Michigan State or to USC to be a doctor, or a lawyer, we would prepare him to do that. Yet kids come to be professional players, not just in the NBA, but in Europe or Australia, wherever. But we don't play the same rules, just as you said, Eric. And so, you know, my big thing is I don't understand why we foul kids out on five fouls. What if a kid commits? I mean, the purpose is to let kids participate. We don't throw anyone out of a football game, you know, or a baseball game if they strike out too much, or, you know, or if they, you know, commit too many offside penalties in football. Who cares? And so I think it's really important. The idea of a technical foul being a personal foul might be the dumbest thing I've ever heard in my life. You know, and it goes on and on. Why we don't have 8 seconds as opposed to 10 to bring it over, but the advancing the ball. You see the finest coaches, Mo, in college basketball look like freaking idiots with 3 seconds to go, and they have the ball out full court, mm-hmm. and they can't even get the ball inbounds or to half court. And I'm talking about Hall of Fame coaches.
Yep.
Where in the NBA, you might win the game if you got the ball up at the other hash mark with 3 seconds to go. There's so many things. But the game, they always say, what's in the best interest of our student athletes, air quotes, okay? And until it comes to making rules and things like that, then we throw all that crap out the window. And it's all about what's best for those coaches.
That's interesting because, you know, when I'm in the States, right, I'm, as you can tell from doing a podcast for a living and being a commentator on the TV, I talk a lot. And whenever I'm in the States and, like, say, for example, I'm on a flight going from one city to another, I strike up a conversation with whoever's sitting next to me, right? If they don't want to talk, we won't talk. But if they want to talk, we'll talk. And we always end up talking about basketball. And a thing that a lot of people in the States say to me, especially the older generation, is they say they don't watch the NBA, but they still watch college basketball because they describe it as pure basketball. What's your take on that?
I mean, the best basketball in the world – is the NBA. And yeah. I mean, my wife and I were watching a college game the other day, and I buy the NBA package every year. And I'm like, let's turn on this random NBA game. And it took like 2 minutes, and Danielle's like, please don't go back to that college game. It's like they're actually making jump shots. I mean, you know, so I mean, if somebody says they don't like, I heard a college coach the other day say that that the NBA wasn't physical and that guys don't play hard. And I'm just like, well, yeah, that obviously the guys never coached in the NBA because the NBA is so physical. The players play so hard that that's a laughable statement. And so that's just lack of knowledge of being there because the players are so great and have such grace at the NBA level. It might appear that they're not playing hard, but it's because they're intelligence and there's no wasted movement. And there's all these reasons why the NBA game players coaching is the best in the world.
Right. And if you don't play hard, you get embarrassed. You get beat by 30 or 40 points. That's
or
how wait, good it goes.
Or cut.
Or I'm not going there. My first weekend coaching in the CBA, Eric was coaching a team down in Florida, and I'm coaching a team in Grand Rapids, Michigan. And the first set of games are played on Friday and Saturday. And back then, Mo, we had fax machines. We didn't. There was no such thing. I don't even know if the internet was invented. Probably was, but I don't know. We didn't have it. And Eric sends out a fax machine. If you're interested in any player on my team, call me. And I said the guy played two games, and he was so beautiful in the way he knows the talent. Anywhere in the world, he taught me the importance of really understanding players. We got to work together in Orlando for the great Chuck Daly for a couple of years. Eric, what was that experience for you like?
Oh, I mean, to this day, the best experience that anybody could have at my age. One, I got to learn from you scouting. I watched all your preps because you had all 82 games. Which I did not think was even humanly possible. I thought only a machine could do that. But you know, not just the fact that the 82 games, but not bringing paper out there, having everything memorized. But then with Coach Daly, I mean, to this day, anything that happens with our team internally, I always ask myself, and even in game, what would Coach Daly do?
Yeah,
because he was a genius. He was way ahead of his time. He was a player's coach, but yet had great accountability towards the players. He was well-liked by all. Everything he did was grace, the way he dressed, the way he talked, the way he met with the media. I just thought, and then I thought in-game, he was just a master manipulator. I mean, he might not like a player, but that player would never know it. And everything he did, like, it was so well thought out. Like, he might run a play for a player knowing the player was going to fail. But there was a reason why he ran the play and why he wanted that player to fail on that possession. And I had just never been exposed to anybody that could see so clearly not just what was happening before him, but what could happen 10 games from then. I mean, he truly could predict the future.
I think it's amazing that, you know, when we speak to these coaches and Coach Cern, how all these coaches take like a little bit of the other great coaches that they've worked under. Who are some of the other coaches that you've learned from and added to your repertoire?
Oh, I mean, so many, but Coach Daly was for sure at the top of the list. But I learned like Doc Rivers. I got to work with Coach Rivers his first year coaching in Orlando.
Right.
And he was unbelievable. Bringing motivational messages to the team. I thought the way that Doc Rivers dealt with the media, I was in awe with how he could subliminally, you know, deliver messages to our team, to our fan base. Mike Fratello, one of the greatest X and O coaches I've ever been around. He had a philosophy. Our team played with an identity. I've never seen a coach so detailed in like post traps. And how he wanted you to trap the post and the rotations on the backside. So those guys. And then although it was just a summer, I did get an opportunity to work with Hubie Brown. We took a team to Limoges, France. And when he was going through our training camp situation, I had no idea what he was doing. I thought, like, is this guy for real? Like, we have a game in 2 weeks. And before the first game happened, he put everything together like this beautiful, perfect puzzle. And I was in awe. And then the intensity that he coached with was on another level.
That was my high school coach, Mo, Hubie Brown.
Wow.
So Hubie brought me to the Atlanta Hawks. Mike Fratello was the other assistant on the Atlanta Hawks. Chuck Daly replaced Chuck Daly at Duke University as an assistant coach. You talk about a tangled web.
Oh, yeah. The coaching trees around basketball are insane. Like, everyone's linked somehow.
Coach Daly, his first NBA head coaching job for my father with Cleveland. But you think about all these, you know, and I probably don't get to work for Mike Fratello unless I work with Coach Brendan Sir. And so all these doors get opened by contacts and people respecting what you do and by being a good team player with other staff members.
You know, I was just looking at some of the players from Arkansas from your time there, 2019 till 2024. And I was looking at the ones that went to the NBA. So you've got Isaiah Joe and Jalen Williams, both champions with the OKC Thunder. You've got Moses Moody, who's on the Warriors. You've got Anthony Black, who's doing very well with the Magic this season. You've got Jordan Walsh, who's been a breakout defensive star with the Celtics. I wanted to pick your brain on this, Coach. When you're coaching these guys at the college level, aside from the obvious physical traits that you can see from a player, what about the mental aspect? What separates the players who are going to make it at the next level versus the ones who aren't? Is there a tell that you have some insight on that these are the mindsets that are different to all of the other guys?
Yeah, I'll kind of go back to Caleb and Cody Martin at Nevada.
Okay.
You know, those guys were so competitive and wanted to improve their games and were thirsty for knowledge. I think that in my experience with college players who go on to the NBA, each of them have their own little reason why they make it and why they stay or why they have success. Like Jalen Williams with Oklahoma City Thunder, he doesn't care about scoring. He cares about moving the ball. He cares about defending. He cares about having great pride in his defensive assignment. And he takes incredible pride in being a great team defensive player. Isaiah Joe he has a knack for being an incredible, incredible shooter, but also being a great teammate and being great in the locker room and having incredible professionalism. So I think the number one trait with all those guys is professionalism, understanding that they might be playing with players that have more talent than them, but that they have to be complementary pieces. And you know, like Moses Moody, the professionalism that he showed, he was like an NBA vet when he was a freshman for us. You know, I had a meeting with him and said, Moses, you're doing a great job shooting from the perimeter, but you're scuffing layups. You're leaving points on the board. People are crowding you because of your jump shot. And the next morning I walked in and he had a manager down there and he was working on 2-foot jump stops and layups and drills that I didn't teach him, but drills that he figured would help him become a better rim finisher. And that's the type of maturity, professionalism that a player, that's why a guy becomes a one and done player, even though he was ranked in the 50s coming out of high school. How could he leapfrog all those other players, all those players that were classes above him? It was because of his professionalism. And you got to have a laser focus of wanting to be an NBA player. That's the one thing about, you know, players right now across the board playing extra years of college. You know, do you want to be a college player for many years or do you want to get to the NBA as quick as possible? And that's the one with this name, image, and likeness. That's the one thing that I'm seeing a shift. But I still think the guys that, you know, like if Moses Moody, he was going to go to the NBA after 1 year or go to the NBA after 1 year in college, no matter what, based on his mentality that his father had kind of groomed him on and what their goals were in life. And but I do think that, you know, Anthony Black, you're talking about a guy that is the like his vision, and he can see plays even at a young age. He could see plays before they formulated. So each guy that I've seen that's gone on to bigger and better things, it's one redeeming quality that maybe is at an elite level that can allow him to have success at the NBA level. Jordan Walsh is going to be, give him another year, he's going to be one of the best defensive stoppers in the NBA. And he's going to be a guy that you can put in a game and he can lock down a superstar on the opposing team. That's a great, great gift when you're a violent defender who takes great pride in the defensive side of the game.
Mus, when you're coaching now in college, and you coached so well at the professional level, both as a head coach at both Golden State and Sacramento, what is it like now when you went out recruiting last year and one of your first rookies, I believe, that you had at Golden State was Gilbert Arenas, who turned into just a star. And if I'm not mistaken, was Gil drafted in the second round?
Yes, he was a second-round draft pick. And that was the year before, Coach, I joined the Warriors, and he didn't really play much his rookie year.
Okay.
And it is a great story. The first practice that I had with Gilbert, I've never left a practice in my entire life, but I ended up walking upstairs in the middle of practice. The GM, Gary St. Jean's office, was right above the practice floor, and I walked up and I said, "Hey, we have an NBA All-Star down here." It was Gary Fitzsimmons, Cotton's son, and I said, "Guys," and they were like, "Who?" You know, and I'm like, I go, "Gilbert Arenas," and they said, "Hey, just give it time. Like, you know, there's a lot of stuff there." And I'm like, "No, this talent is. We need, like, let's sign him now to like a lifetime contract." And that's how talented Gilbert was. But wow, what a wild turn of events to now be coaching his son Elijah. One, it shows you that you're getting old as a coach. But I think you guys, the greatest compliment that a former player could ever give, the greatest compliment of all, is to allow you to coach his son.
Yeah.
And especially if that son is a five-star. Who's going to play in the NBA and has lottery pick potential. And it just happened recently. We got two commitments, from Theo Ratliff's sons.
Wow.
And I had Theo as an assistant coach with the Hawks when I worked for Lon Kruger, and now Adonis and Darius have signed with us. And so that'll be three players that are former, you know, their fathers played for me, and it's pretty cool compliment.
So last spring, when I see that Elijah's going with Eric, I call him up and I said, "I just watched this kid's highlight tape." And I said, "I hate to say it, I think he's like at the same age I watched Kobe Bryant play live." I said, "He does a lot of things better. That's how good he is, right?"
I remember that phone call. It made me feel really good.
Yeah. No, I mean, yeah. I was putting some heat on you in case you didn't win, you know. With
that's a lot of pressure.
No, but that's how good he is, you know. And I just think it's Eric, in coaching at the college or pro level, what's the hardest thing in coaching nowadays, or at any time really? Coaching good players, what's the hardest thing?
I think with a team and an individual player, it's just buy-in, you know, and trust, I think that's. You know, an emotional connection with guys as well. Like, I think all those things are, because coaching, just like everything in life, is changing. I think that the way that we talk, film sessions, all those things at the collegiate level are kind of moving closer and closer to the NBA, where it's a little bit more of a partnership than maybe it was 8 or 9 years ago. The NBA has always been about partnership, and it's always been about, the players are the stars. The coach is just, you know, trying to keep the thing on the train track, so to speak, and get it moving in the right direction and offer guidance. And college, you still have to develop. You're still, you know, trying to grow, you know, people as players and people. But I do think it's become more of a partnership at this level than maybe I ever would have anticipated a few years ago. And then you add in the name, image, and likeness, and I mean, quite frankly, there's players on your current college rosters that are making more money than assistant coaches. That adds a completely different dynamic when maybe one player is making more than your entire staff combined. So all those things, you know, change the dynamics of stuff.
Back in the day, you know, if there was a player had a problem with the coach was fired, Mo.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Yeah. And you know, it can still happen, I think, in college with name, image, and likeness, you know, where it was the other way around. Because there are some players at some of these colleges that are making way more than a minimum NBA contract. Right, Eric?
Yeah, and marginal players, this is the, you know, a kind of a sad thing is marginal collegiate players are now making more than star G League players. And it puts a little bit of a, I mean, it's great for the players, it's great for the players' family, but I do think it puts a little bit of a false sense into maybe what's about to come. You know, because first-year players that have pretty good college careers and are pretty good college players, like their first job overseas is going to be roughly $50,000 to $80,000. And when a player is used to making a lot more than that, and then they find out that that's their value overseas, it can be hard for the player to understand that and digest it. And that's, we've experienced it even with some guys from last year's team, that this is reality. That's if that's what the European market says you're worth, that's what you're worth. And that can be very difficult, you know, to go from making really good money at the collegiate level to think you're beginning your pro career and you take a step back financially.
Coach, with, you know, such a busy schedule in the NCAA and such limited time to get your team together, how much of the time is spent on the X's and O's and the plays that, you know, the tactics that you're going to have during the game versus preparing these young men for life after college basketball?
Well, I think the number one priority is the preparation for life after basketball. So what does that mean? That means understanding what being a good teammate, because no matter what walk of life you are, you're going to have to be a teammate to someone in some company, some corporation. Letting the player know that basketball is going to stop sometime between the age of 31 and 40. No matter how great you are, that's your timeline. And so you're going to have to do something once you're done playing basketball. So preparation of life beyond basketball. And I think, you know, basketball can teach you everything that you need to know about life, you know, when you move on. And so that's a really, really big part of what we do on a daily basis. And then in the summer, because, you know, rosters are changing so frequently, trying to get a team to mesh and bond and have connection is a big, big part of what not just NCAA basketball coaches, but football coaches and coaches all across these campuses are trying to figure out what's the best way to do that. And I do think that having a professional background makes it a little bit easier because you're used to a in-season trade. If you're coaching in the minor leagues, you're used to roster changing. And so I do think that better equips you to try to get a team together as quick as possible.
And Mo, one of the guys that we really need to mention that's important to Mus and is that his dad, when he took over as the head coach of Minnesota, the first coach of the Minnesota Timberwolves, his assistant was Tom Thibodeau.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. And so Eric and he were on the same staff and really are close and stuff like that. And talk about Tibbs as a coach, right? You know, I mean, you know, right now, out of sight, out of mind, and did an incredible job with the Knicks, you know, seventh game of the Eastern Conference Finals, and he's out. And then another one of your mafia at USD wins the Emirates Cup last night, you know, and Mike Brown.
Yeah, so, I mean, the San Diego Mafia is true. It's real. I listened to the entire podcast with Coach Fizdale and both of you this morning, actually, when I was working out. And Mike Brown's doing a great job with the Knicks. Yeah. He really is. I mean, that was a great win to win the Cup. And then, you know, with Tom Thibodeau, you know, when my dad was coaching Albany, Patroons in the old CBA, Tom Thibodeau was at Harvard. And Tom used to drive from Harvard to Albany to watch minor league practices. And my dad just respected Tom's work ethic so much that he hired Tom to be an assistant coach. He believed in Tom. When we got fired with the Timberwolves, one of the first things my dad did was pick up the phone and get Tom Thibodeau an assistant coaching job with Jerry Tarkanian and the Spurs. And I remember saying to my dad, yo, like, I don't have a job either. Like, what? You just got Tim's a job and I'm sitting here out on the curb, man. Like, but my dad believed in Tom. And I will tell you guys, because this is a great leadership / coaching lesson, you know, because Tom and I knew each other at such a young age, I did feel that there was a time in Coach Thibodeau's life where there was some frustration of not becoming a head coach. I had, you know, gotten a job with the Warriors and Kings as a head coach, and Tom was an assistant coach, and an assistant coach with having great success, winning at a high, high level. And, you know, when he did get his first job, he was super prepared. And I remember having the conversation with him. You remember all those years that you were frustrated? Well, I'm not getting an NBA head job right now because I got a job when I was too young, too inexperienced, not mature enough. And now think about your career and how prepared you were, how many great coaches you got to learn from. Sometimes patience is the greatest thing because, and Coach Sir, you probably had the exact age, but Coach Daly didn't get his first head job until he was after 50 years old as an NBA right. head coach. And sometimes when guys get a job too early, it can hurt you. And sometimes coaches, you look at the Indiana football coach right now, he got a job at a late age and he was super, super prepared. I just had this conversation this morning. Earl Watson is doing our TV game and Earl got a job as the second youngest head coach in NBA history.
Right.
And he and I were exchanging notes on sometimes it's a blessing, but can also be a curse.
You know, that's pretty powerful.
A big part of what you do now coaching in the NCAA is recruiting players, right? And I want to ask this question on behalf of all of our listeners who are here in the UK and Europe and Middle East and Africa, so on and so forth, because now we're seeing an influx of international players in college because the rules have changed. What do you look for when you're recruiting players? What's the top three things that stand out to you?
Yeah, I think one, you know, much like Al Davis when he was running the Raiders, is like, you know, what do you want your team to look like coming off the bus? You know, for us in general terms, you know, there's a characteristic of length, athleticism, and ability to react that are super important to me. And then toughness, competitiveness, and wanting to, you know, get in the gym and work on your game, especially at the collegiate level. Those are the characteristics, you know, that we look for in a player. And we talk about all the time. And quite frankly, you know, out of the last 11 years or whatever, the two seasons that I look back and we didn't have as much success, it's because we got away from what is important in our player profile, so to speak.
You know, Eric, you're a big time, have a big time growth mindset. And every morning when you're working out, you're learning from someone. What do you base what you look for to keep learning? Because it never ends and stuff like that. What are your interests?
Other sports other than basketball.
Right.
You know,
I
think the best coaches of any sport are football. Because they have to be organized. They have so many players.
Well, your kind of football or my kind of football?
Not your kind of football. Not your kind. Only Pep over there. We like Pep. But I'm joking. But, yeah.
Sorry, carry on.
So, I mean, like I like to watch press conferences after wins, after losses of other coaches of other sports. I love the fact that now social media teams – are now allowed in locker rooms so you can see what like NFL coaches are doing post game. But Coach Sir's right. Like every morning I get on the treadmill, obviously for cardiovascular work, but most importantly, it's to learn. And I print articles. I just Google head coach or Major League Baseball manager or NFL coach, and print these articles and read, highlight, share them with my team, share them with other coaches. And so just a constant thirst to try to get better. I mean, there's so many great coaches out there in other sports that we all can learn. And it's at your fingertips. If you're not learning, it's really on you.
Have you ever heard of a coach from my kind of football called Jose Mourinho?
I have. Yep.
Now, he, for me, is the greatest coach I've seen. The way that he is, you know, not just from a tactical standpoint on the pitch, but also how he manipulates the media, like you said about Chuck Daly. But, you know, he's so dedicated. There was a game where he was suspended and he wasn't allowed to be at the game.
Right.
He snuck in the laundry basket of the kit man, and he hid in this tiny little laundry basket, got wheeled in, gave his team talk, and got wheeled out. Like, if you want to learn about coaches, you got to research here.
I don't know anyone that would do that on this call right now. I really don't know anyone that might do that.
You got a story for us, coach?
No, light bulb just went on in Mus's head. He said, I like that. That's a freaking great idea.
The only thing I'm thinking about is what would be the fine once somebody found out.
It was too late. By the time they found out he had already coached two other teams, and then there was another game. There was another game where he was suspended because he kept getting suspended for arguing with the referees, right? And there was another game he's suspended. His assistant coach has just got AirPods in, and he's just talking to him on the phone.
Like that.
And it's like
it's
in front of everyone, and they can't do anything because the game started.
I love that. That's actually good. In looking at what makes a great coach, I've broken it down what I think are four important areas. Number one, a coach has to be a leader, but has to have incredible courage to be able to get in front of his team, make, as our friend Mike Lombardi says, you got to be able to talk to your team and you got to tell them the truth. Number one, you got to be competent because the players are your students and they know if you know what the hell you're talking about. The third thing, if you have it, is credibility. Because now all of a sudden, they're going to give you that buy-in because they know you've done it with other people. And the most important thing maybe now, they're all equally important, but the thing now with the kids, especially that you're, is that ability to connect with your players. Any comments on those four or add-ons?
Yeah, I mean, I think the connection part is super, super important for sure. Yeah. Everything that you just talked about really synopsis what has to happen as a head coach. I mean, you know, the buy-in and the credibility. I mean, you know, I do think that, you know, when you are a coach like Chuck Daly, I mean, the credibility, like when I look at coaching hires and stuff, and I think like coach, there's no way Coach Daly was ever going to fail once he had reached the point that he was coaching the Orlando Magic, because the credibility in that locker room, no matter what he said, because of the past of winning and how his former players had talked about him, he was destined to win at a high level. And I do think there's a lot of truth in when a coach gains credibility in his industry, how it's really hard. It's much harder to fail than when someone's coming up through the ranks and trying to gain credibility.
Hey, Mus, when assistant coaches, as we both know, are incredibly important to a coach, head coach's success. So when Chuck and I leave the Pistons and we go to the New Jersey Nets, which is at, you know, it's a really bad job. It's a really bad job. And the assistant coaches are myself, Paul Silas, and Rick Carlisle. And we're sitting there one day before the season, and all the three assistants are doing is bitching and moaning about how bad our ownership is with the New Jersey Nets. And Chuck lets us just kill these guys, seven of them, for about a half hour. And he says, are you guys done? And we go, what do you mean? Really, we're not? No. And he says, the last time I looked, this is the best job you three son of a bitches got. Let's get to work. And I said, wow. I mean, talk about putting us back to reality very quickly. You can complain all you want, but you guys are sitting here right now and you don't got a better job. So let's go. And those are two of Paul Silas, absolutely incredible. Rick Carlisle, arguably last year, maybe the best coach in the league. I mean, Chuck had that ability to just put us in our tracks really quick. He told Eric and I one day, as we were sitting in his office, Eric, you know what I'm going to tell us. We're like, Eric and I, like, we're like ready to take over and be the head coach if Chuck retires. And he looks at Eric, he looks at me, and what did he tell us? We're what?
Dinosaurs.
Exactly. He says, we're all, the three of us are dinosaurs. He said, they're not hiring us anymore. They're going to hire former players. You're done. And like, Chuck's 69 years old.
I'm 26 years old, and he's telling me I'm a dinosaur.
He's worth millions, all right? I got two kids that need to go to college and stuff, and this guy's telling me I'm a dinosaur. And I left a 10-year contract in Toronto to come here because I wanted to be near Disney World. And I, like, this guy has just told me I'm a dinosaur and I'm going to be unemployed.
Well, the best Chuck Daly story, and Brennan, I've heard you tell it recently on a podcast, is when he retired from the Magic. That was, you know, one of the lowest moments in someone's career to know that you're not working for Chuck Daly and you're not working for the Orlando Magic. But when he had the opportunity to coach the Lakers.
Right.
And then you think about how all of our lives would have changed.
He takes Eric and I out to the best steakhouse in Orlando a week after he walks away and quits. And we're having this incredible dinner. And it's just fabulous. And in the middle of dinner, he says, hey, Shaq came to see me yesterday because they lived in the same area. And he says, he offered me the Lakers job per Jerry West. And Chuck loved Los Angeles. He was made for Beverly Hills. He loved it. And Eric and I like sit up in our seats. Eric loves the West Coast. And I'm like, going, I like LA too. We're moving to LA. And he goes, I told him, no, I don't want to do it. I'm telling you, the two of us just said, what the fuck, in the restaurant, and the people are turning. We're going crazy. And he just says, yeah, I told him we don't do it. Then he says, I thought about it about 3 days later and told him, yeah, I do want that job. Yeah, I do want that job. Yeah, I mean, but already they just went and hired Phil Jackson. And that we could have been there with Kobe and Shaq for, like, you know, three championships.
That's crazy. That is crazy. Mus, while we've got you here, you know, a lot of people are interested in this upcoming NBA draft. And who knows the players better? You know, you got to prepare to play against some of these guys. You're coaching some of these guys. Who are, if you had to predict how the top five of the draft is going to go, how would that look in your head at this point?
Well, while some of them I recruited and lost out in the recruiting battle, so I have like those guys that said no to us, I have a biased opinion, you know, drop them a little bit. But Darren Peterson's phenomenal. I mean, he really is. We did recruit him. We were in his small, finite group at the end, along with Ohio State, and obviously went to Kansas. But he's high character, you know, good family. You know, he's been coached by guys like Sam Mitchell when he played AAU basketball, and now he's, you know, getting great coaching at Kansas. So, I mean, he's an incredible player. You know, AJ at BYU being coached by, you know, a guy that coached in the NBA is a really good coach. So he's going to be prepared. And, you know, North Carolina's got, you know, Caleb Wilson, and we recruited Caleb really, really hard as well.
Wow.
And so, I mean, those three guys are really, really good. But, you know, you never know what player overseas is going to, you know, emerge in the next couple months. And but there are a lot of great players in college right now. And as we all know, the NBA draft, you know, they like players that are young. I mean, players that are going to grow their game. And so, you know, you got to look at that freshman class and see who's really playing well, and that group towards the end, once you get to March, because things are going to change between now and March. Once you start talking about the 4th through the 9th, 10th pick, those change. I think that, you know, guys that are solidified themselves in the top 5 or 6, there's very little movement, so to speak.
You like a Boozer's game Eric?
I do. We didn't recruit him, so I didn't mention it.
he has such bias about winning and losing. It's great, though.
The thing with Boozer is he knows who he is, and he doesn't play outside his game. And I think he's going to be able to step into the NBA right away
and have
a role where other guys are going to have to change what they're doing now to blend in with an NBA team. But I think Boozer is a guy that's just going to be able to literally walk off his college team, get drafted, and have an incredible role that everybody knows kind of how he's going to blend in with the current roster.
And the young man, Arizona, obviously, I think if they're still number one, I believe, really have a good team. And, of course, a terrific coach over there.
Yeah, I mean, both kids at Arizona. I mean, I look at Coa Pete, you know, and he played for a great AAU program. He's super physical. His body's ready to go right now. Yep. Braden Burries is a guy that really, you know, in the last couple of weeks is – you know, coming on and there's another guy that we're in his top two. But Burries is, you know, he's got great size and length, and he's going to be a point guard. And so there's just a lot of really, really good freshmen that have unlimited upside when you think about the next level.
It's an exciting time for sure. There's a lot of teams in the NBA who are
that's not Eric's dog. That's one of his players calling in for more playing time. That's all right.
Eric, we appreciate you joining us on the show, man. We really do appreciate you taking the time.
We appreciate being on. It's great to meet you, Mo. Coach, it's always great joining with you.
Oh, Mus, you're the best. Good luck, man. And you're going to have a great year. And I love visiting with you, as always.
Thanks, you guys.
Yeah, we wish you the best for the upcoming season. We hope you guys at home enjoyed that interview. Make sure you lock in and check out what USC are doing this year. And subscribe to the show, YouTube, Spotify, Apple, wherever you get your podcasts from. And until next time, as always, get buckets.